Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Clinical Pharmacist Podcast. As you know, we've started a new series recently where we are discussing various topics that cover how different sectors across the pharmacy world work collaboratively to support our patients in the NHS. And co-hosting this series with me is Amina Ali, who I introduced last week, who is an experienced IP pharmacist who's worked both in community and primary care, who is the NCL Training Ambassador. In today's episode, we will be discussing how to deal with drug shortages in primary care. And our guest for this episode is pharmacist Arif Badalia, who has been a pharmacist for 15 years, who is currently a co-owner, superintendent pharmacist, also a prescriber, and has worked in primary care in a GP practice and still occasionally locums for a GP surgery. Arif is also a lead pharmacist for a clinical research company and has been involved in 6 trials so far. So that's really interesting. Welcome to the both of you, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Right. So as we know, drug shortages are becoming a common problem more and more as time is going on, unfortunately. And so it's becoming a frequent issue. And we know that it can hinder the pharmacy teams, both in the community sector and in the general practice sector, to dispense medication and issue prescriptions so that the patients can receive their treatment in a timely manner. And obviously, it has been an ongoing issue that's seriously impacting the current supply problems. And obviously, it's affecting our workload as well. And ultimately, our patients, if it does end up resulting in a serious delay to treatment, especially when it's difficult to get hold of alternatives. So I think, Arif, maybe we can start off with perhaps what sort of trend you've seen over the years coming from the community pharmacy sector as a owner in a community pharmacy. What's it been like? Do you agree that this is an issue that's sort of on the rise? How have things changed over the last few years? Brexit have anything to do with it? You know, what are the reasons for this? So it'd be nice to get your input on that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. So, I mean, it's very simple. There's a trend, and the trend, fortunately, is going that way in terms of the amount of drugs which we cannot get hold of. Or we can get hold of them, but the price is so inflated that it's almost kind of pricing pharmacies out of the market. So if I go back even 6-7 years ago, right? So we're talking 2017, 2018. I'll be honest, and I'm a bit embarrassed to say this, I didn't even know what price concessions were. I knew what it was, and would get on our PMR system a little pop-up coming up at the end of the month saying, you know, there's 15 items on there. And I'll be like, okay, click. I don't need to worry about that. Because normally, even those 15, 18 items, it would be kind of random drugs that you never see, or the odd one that you use maybe once a month, a few times a month. So you kind of know about it, or kind of found alternatives or arrangements or something like that. So it would take like a minimal amount of your time, your monthly cycle. Now, if we go for the most recent concessions list, it's hitting 150, 160 drugs a month, okay? So that in itself, the trend is there, right? 20 to 150. And it's not random stuff you're giving out here and there. It's regular, high quantity, common items that we are using all the time. And that's what's the real issue, I think. It's the fact that it's not your Joe Blog drug. It's your bread and butter drug that you're, you know, atorvastatin. I think we all know what happened last year with that. I mean, my pharmacy gives out 300 packs a month of one strength. Not all strength, just one strength of atorvastatin, 300. Even if some of them are on, you know, 56 days, that's 150 patients for one strength of one drug in one pharmacy. You times that by 11,000 pharmacies in a country, all the surgeries, I mean, it was mayhem, wasn't it, last year with atorvastatin. So yeah, the trend's there, unfortunately, and it looks like it's here to stay for the foreseeable future.
I see. Okay. So thank you for shedding light on that, Arif. So it's obviously something that we as pharmacists need to be ready for, to tackle, to support not only our team members, but also our patients, just so we can sort of anticipate and navigate around these issues. So I think the aim of today's podcast is to sort of support our pharmacy teams, both in the community and the general practice sector, how to navigate these teams. And of course, it's important that we're working collaboratively, and hence the other name of the series as well. You know, general practice pharmacists, how can we work with the primary care or the community pharmacies to navigate these shortages? What are some of the common pitfalls that you see that can be easily resolved from the pharmacists working in the general practice sector? What are the things that sort of are frustrating for you? I'm sure we've got our frustrations, and Amina, we can discuss those as well. So we'd like some of our community pharmacy team members to start doing, so we can navigate these shortages more smoothly and come to solutions more quickly. So what are some of the things that you've seen that you think we could overcome easily? And, you know, if you've got any tips or solutions that you've put in place that have helped with dealing with these problems?
Yeah, so I think number one, from the pharmacy point of view, what I think most pharmacies have done now is just try to keep more stock of everything. Yeah, just try to keep as much as you physically can keep, because you never know when the next kind of issue, which drug is going to be an issue. Like before, I think you'd never think paracetamol ever going out of stock, amlodipine going out of stock, bisoprolol. You know, things were just so bread and butter. You just, yeah, you want 100? Yeah, order 100. You want 10? You want 1? Whatever you want. You've got 6 suppliers. Every single one has got them in stock. But it's not like that now. So I think number one, pharmacies need to kind of increase their stock slightly. That comes with risk and whatnot. Each business and each pharmacy needs to kind of make their own decisions. But I've consciously tried to keep more stock of the drugs to try to mitigate some of these fluctuations of prices and availability in the market. Okay. And I think a really big one is your relationship with your GP. So I'm quite lucky where I have a very good relationship with the local GPs in my area. So we have a kind of super practice with about 90,000 patients, and it's spread across kind of 10 or 11 sites, which makes up, I would say, 80% of our PCN. And so what I do is every month, the pharmacy tech that works within the practice, we have a monthly call, lasts about 20-25 minutes, where we update each other on the current drugs which are out of stock or which are in stock, which are hard to get, or the prices are so crazy, where I'll say, look, I think you're going to start getting pharmacies rejecting scripts because it's available, not as easily available, but it is available, but the cost is crazy. So I'll give an example. Ezetimibe 10 milligram tablets, recently there's been a kind of issue with it. So it's, don't quote me, I think roughly it's about 189 on drug tariff, something like that. And the cheapest I was getting it was £10 something, 10.50, 10.60. So that means for every box we hand out, the pharmacy is losing over £9. Okay. So I was thinking, oh, okay, maybe we'll just have to bite the bullet and, you know, go for it. The next day, I checked the prices again. It went to £42. Drug tariff is still 1.89. Or £1, whatever it was. So, and just, it so happened on that day, I had the phone call with the pharmacy tech. And I said, I think we're going to have an issue here, because you're going to have pharmacies rejecting, even though they might be able to get it. Imagine just dispensing 10 boxes and you've lost £400. It's crazy. And this is the situation that's happening within the pharmacy sector. So I think having that relationship with the GP, so what she does, she compiles the list that I give her or we talk together, and then she distributes it to all the GP surgeries. So all the clinicians in those surgeries, all the doctors, the pharmacists, everyone that's associated with those surgeries, all know what drugs to kind of look out for, trying not to initiate, or they've already gone inkling, okay, you know what, we're going to have issues with these drugs in the next month. So I tried to give information, for example, when the drugs might be coming back in stocks, if I've got any market information of drugs which are currently out to stock, and they might be coming back in the next 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks. So that helps with the planning, with their prescribing as well. So I think that's been quite good, to give that information, and then the GP surgery then take that and then use that for their benefit as well.
Okay, that's fantastic. I think those sound like really good solutions. Having that, as you say, monthly sort of meeting and, you know, touch base with the general practicing is crucial. As we know, you know, it all comes down to communication, doesn't it? Amina, what are your thoughts and what questions do you have for Arif?
So I'm really, really glad that Arif brought up the issue of, you know, relationship between the pharmacy and general practice, because I think that's really the crux of it. And Arif, can you CC me in on this monthly update? Oh my gosh, it sounds like a godsend. Because from our point of view, there are multiple tools that we can use in terms of trying to work out what is available, what isn't available. But that becomes useless when you have the patient there telling you that their pharmacy is telling them that something isn't available. There's not much way around that, okay? So in terms of, from my perspective, as a GP pharmacist, as a prescriber, don't forget, we are anointed the experts, aren't we, when we're in general practice. Any problem with medicines, give it to the pharmacist. So it becomes solely our problem. What would be really, really helpful, because we can't see what's physically in your stock. Only you can see that. We can only see the information that is available via, you know, resources and tools online about what's the general trend is nationally. But I don't know what's in your pharmacy. Okay. So if you do send back a patient to the GP practice, give them a viable alternative. Give them something that you are stocking. And if there is no viable alternative, then tell us. Because what that tells us is that actually we need to do a clinical review and consider a completely different kind of approach. Okay. So it's like the ezetimibe problem. There wasn't really an alternative to that. So really, it was an opportunity for us to go back to the conversation about statin, looking at intolerance. Is it true intolerance or is it a nocebo effect, which is something well known with statins? But you see, when we have that information, we're able to then move to that next step and do that and have that conversation with the patient. We can even assess in that scenario, for example, whether we can reaffirm lifestyle approaches and other non-pharmacological options. So as bad as stock problems are, and I absolutely demise at the level of the problem, for some instances, it's an opportunity to review the patient. And actually, I welcome opportunities to review the patient, even if it is thrust upon us and forced upon us. I think the GLP crisis is a classic example of actually a situation where we've been forced to review patients. And what we found is that actually there's situations where some patients were not suitable for GLP, and actually they may have been initiated inappropriately because for whatever reason, they managed to get an initial prescription and then that continued. So if a viable opportunity arises where we can review, fantastic. If you are able to give us a viable alternative, fantastic. It's that information that we need that is going to make us provide an alternative or provide a review that's going to be in the best interest of the patient. At the end of all of this, it's the patient that suffers. Okay, so whatever's going on in the background with us, with the industry, with the sector, it's the patient that's suffering. It's the patient that's ping-ponging between the surgery and the pharmacy. And actually what we should be doing is working as closely together as possible to try and find sort of pragmatic approaches to manage this. So if we know there's a particular pattern, then we can already kind of forecast, okay, this is a viable alternative or that's a viable alternative. And what I want to hear from the pharmacy is, can you order it? That's what I want to know. Because if I'm going to prescribe something, I'm prescribing it blind, not knowing whether you're going to be able to order it. And that's what I want to know is, are you going to be getting it in? Because I don't want my patient coming back to me because they were unable to give the alternative that I suggested.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Amina, because I think that communication that I have with the tech from the GP. So within that list that we're discussing, she's obviously asking me for alternatives. So what I do, I'm giving kind of real-time market data. I'm there with my ordering system and checking, okay, this is available, but this is not available. This is the price of this. I think you're going to find this difficult to get a hold of from most pharmacies. So, you know, I think with that setup that I've got, I'm hoping that the GP surgery do find it helpful. You can probably try to get the spreadsheets that she creates every month from that. The other issue is actually, I know this might sound a bit crazy, but sometimes even we don't know what's available. So what happened is I'll check on my system and they'll say, yeah, it's in stock. And then check the next day and it's gone out again. And then the pharmacy looks really silly because the prescriptions now come in. I've given an alternative and even the alternative's gone. So I think there has to be some understanding between everyone that sometimes, no matter how hard we try, and unfortunately to the detriment of the ping-ponging of the patient, it's just going to happen where the pharmacist will just struggle to get the normal drug and the alternative. So it's not ideal. I think we all know that over the last few years, it's been very difficult with the drug shortages and the prices. And like I said, I think there's plenty of reasons why that's happening. Brexit is definitely one. The war of Ukraine, the Middle East wars, the general kind of post-pandemic recession, the global recession was going on. Also, the way payments are set up in the industry, how the manufacturers get paid from the governments. So all of these kind of reasons all come together and we're in a kind of a perfect storm, unfortunately, with drug shortages. And like I said, it's going to continue for a long time. So I think communication, I think if there's one thing we all take away is definitely the communication between the sectors of, you know, GP community, and even secondary care. I think that can really reduce some of the ping-ponging for the patient and disruption to their lives, really.
So I think, you know, obviously, Arif, you've approached this in a really proactive manner. You know, you're having the monthly meetings with your general practice team, which is fantastic for your area and your PCN, just generally for, you know, the wider country where, you know, obviously this problem is very widespread. And we've got pharmacists, for example, within our organization who are working all over the country. Obviously, I think my advice would be, you know, if you haven't got your community pharmacists reaching out to your team and are regularly updating the general practice team with what's out of stock, what's in stock, how to go about the shortages, would you say that the general practice pharmacists should go ahead and reach out to their community pharmacies? What's the best way of going about that? Because obviously, there are going to be hundreds of pharmacies out there or within sort of small vicinity. What's the best way of getting that communication out there? You know, some pharmacists who are working in general practice, they've either haven't been working in community pharmacy for a long time, so they've forgotten how things operate, or some of them have never actually worked in a community pharmacy setting. So what advice would you give to pharmacists from the general practice sector to go ahead and, you know, use that initiative if they haven't been approached by the community pharmacy team?
Absolutely, Runa. I think that's a really good point. I think generally speaking, right, and I might be generalizing a bit too much, but I think GPs generally as a sector are quite intimidating to both patients and to pharmacies. So I'll give an example. Like, patients always come to me and say, oh, can you give this to my GP surgery? Can you hand this in? And so I work within a practice. So my pharmacy is co-located within the GP practice. And I'm like, it's 15 meters that way. No, you do it. I'm like, okay, we'll do it. So there is this perception of intimidation, right? And pharmacists, I'm talking about community pharmacists, probably feel the same way. There's also the thing where GP as a institution, their time's very valuable, okay? So we don't really want to be, even though we want to communicate, if you're not kind of a chatty box like me, you might not have the confidence, or you might not have guts of just saying, okay, guys, a doctor, X, so and so, can you sit down with me? Or can you get one of your staff to sit down with me? You know, it just doesn't happen. So I think if the GP can initiate that, if they can get one of their staff to do what we do, something like that, I'm telling you now, okay, again, generalizing, but 9 out of 10, at least 90% of all pharmacists in the country, if the GP surgery contacts them and says, do you mind giving us a bit of real-time market information, 15, 20 minutes every month? You know, if Runa calls you every 20th of every month or whatever, do you mind giving her 15, 20 minutes? I'm telling you, they will bite your hand off. They'll be like, yeah, absolutely. Because they know their life is about to get easy as well. And actually, they know that if they start those lines of communication, it opens up opportunities for the pharmacist in future to ask for favors from the GP. Now, favors in terms of, oh, you know what, doctor, I've got this patient, we have these issues, do you mind if we kind of sync all these patients up? You know, favors in terms of clinical favors, where GPs can't be bothered or they haven't got time to do it. But pharmacists, it really affects our day-to-day kind of dispensing, having a patient with 10 items on their drug list, 5 of them are monthly, 2 of them are 2 monthly, and 1 of them is 3 monthly. And it's like, you know what? The patient comes 3 times a month. We dispense 3 times a month. We request 3 times a month, right? Pharmacists might put a request in, but they don't have that relationship with the GP, where the GP actually almost takes it seriously. And so it's just forgotten about. So if pharmacists have that relationship with the GP, honestly, it's a very, very mutually beneficial situation where the GPs benefit and the pharmacists benefit. And guess what? The patients benefit. Always what happens is when the relationship increases between the two sectors, life becomes better for the patient. So I would say that all you GP pharmacists, GP techs, you know, whoever you are, contact your local pharmacy, contact your community pharmacy. If you don't bite, we're nice. And honestly, I think you'll see a big uplift in the amount of work that you can get done, definitely.
Well, that's really interesting. I think that sometimes we forget, after being out of the community pharmacy sector for so long, you're right. I think when I think back to my community pharmacy years, I think I was probably a little intimidated by the staff at the GP practice. So yeah, you're absolutely right. And in terms of workload, you know, not only is it beneficial for the patient and the community pharmacy team, but it is becoming a huge sort of burden in terms of workload for the general practice team as well. You know, the number of tasks that we have sitting in our inbox with a pharmacists to do to say, you know, all of these drugs need alternatives. And then we're having to either speak to the patient individually or ring up multiple pharmacies. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And it's fantastic advice. And hopefully, you know, all the general practice pharmacists listening can take you up on that and take that initiative to sort of have things in place to anticipate these problems so we can deal with them in a timely and efficient manner. What are your thoughts on sending a patient round with an individual prescription to perhaps different pharmacies? Just obviously the pharmacy owner yourself, or perhaps we are, you know, we've used the Boots prescription tracker tool, and then obviously there are multiple, perhaps they have better buying power. How do you guys feel, especially independent pharmacies, when we get patients to take their prescriptions elsewhere? Does that impact you guys much? Or is it even a problem, or is it not really something that we should avoid doing?
If we can't get hold of the item for whatever reason, then absolutely. I mean, I had this situation literally just yesterday. Oxybutynin 5 milligrams modified release. So I've got 10 milligrams modified release. I can get hold of them, but for some reason, and I've got 7 suppliers, right? So all your usual AH Alliance, you know, all the rest, and all the mid and small level wholesalers. And I just can't get it anywhere. So I've spoken to the GP. I said, look, so I've given out 3 items on the prescription. The fourth one I can't get hold of. Now, I can't give that token back to the patient because I've dispensed all the other items. So I've gone to the GP. I said, look, can we cancel that one? And can you just create a new prescription just for that? So it's done. So within 5 minutes, that was sorted, right? So the patient's happy that she's not having to wait for a long time. I said, I've asked the 3 local independents. No one's got it. Okay. Do you want to have a look to any other pharmacies in the area? She's like, yeah, I'm going to try Asda, try Boots. I'm going to try the Well Pharmacy. I said, sure. She comes back to me literally the next day and say, I found it, Arif. I was like, oh, where'd you find it? She goes, only Asda had it. So Boots didn't have it. Well didn't have it, but Asda. And I said, did they have to order it for you? She did. No, they had it in stock. So I said to her, look, we're all finding it very difficult to order new stock in, and we all use the same wholesalers. However, you may get lucky and a pharmacy may have some in stock already. And that's basically what happened. So I have no issue whatsoever. And I think most pharmacies don't. I mean, why are we going to hold on to one item for £1.27? Like, you know, yay, £1.27. You know, the patient's going to lose out on getting his medication. So I think most pharmacists and pharmacies are quite pragmatic. They're quite sensible. Look, there's always exception to the rule. We've heard stories all over the show of people who try to hold on to scripts and whatnot. But generally, you know, I don't mind at all. I was happy the patient's got it. And because I helped her and she knows that I tried to make her life as easy as possible, I know she's always going to stick with me because she knows I'm helpful. You know, so it's, you know, the issue becomes where I can't ever get hold of that item for whatever reason. And then me trying to hold on to that patient is not viable either. It's not fair. So then you've got to let go if for whatever reason you can't get hold of that item. So I would say from your point of view, from the GP kind of point of view, that's fine. It's not an issue. But it's all down to communication though. So communicate with the patient, communicate with the pharmacy. As long as the pharmacy knows that you're doing the best for the patient and, you know, they're not going to take it to heart, then hopefully she'll be all right. But I'm giving very general kind of, you know, information. We get characters all over the show, so just gotta be a bit, yes. But generally, I think your pharmacies without line really.
Okay, that's good to hear. I think it's something that, you know, we've encouraged our pharmacists to do to sort of resolve the issue. I don't think they've come across, you know, too much resistance, but I thought it would be interesting to get the perspective of the community pharmacists as well, just to make sure that we're not winding up people too much. But of course, as you say, we always have to work. Everyone, you know, as a clinician, need to work in the best interest of the patient. Another thing I wanted to touch upon. So I'm going to go ahead.
Can I just ask a question about how you feel? So sometimes I get patients coming in saying, because, you know, some things we prescribe in brand because of the payments associated with it. So we might get a patient coming in saying, oh, my pharmacy said that this brand isn't available. And then they haven't been given an alternative brand that's available. And so my approach, which I think is pragmatic, would be to prescribe generically so that then you have the opportunity to provide what you do have in stock. Now, there have been some occasions where my prescriptions have been pushed back when I've prescribed them generically. I just wanted to know your opinion as a community pharmacist about how you feel about generic prescribing.
I always say to all my prescribers, please, please prescribe generic. It just opens up the opportunities for us to not get bogged down with, I like this brand, I don't like this brand. The brands are changing constantly. once you kind of prescribe a brand and that's it, and some patients in their mind that this is the only thing that works, that's my medicine, how many times you kind of explain it to them? To be honest, we get bogged down. So for example, if, you know, metformin is being prescribed and I've given an activist brand because that's what I've got, then the next month, because I might have Relon came or something, the patient's like, no, 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 that's not my medicine. This is my medicine. And I'm like, it's the same thing. Like, so even we get in that kind of conversations just because we might have had a certain brand for a while. And now with new branding from the wholesalers, the patients are now, you know, confused or just not having it. So it's that's a whole different topic there, Amina, with brands. But generally, if you prescribe, I think most pharmacies were happy. The only time where I've recently come across a situation, I think it was with ezetimibe. Mm. And last month, one of the GPs called me and said, Arif, is a problem with it? I was like, yeah, there is an issue. And I looked at her, I said, we can't get hold of it, but it's a little bit expensive. And then she's like, that's why. I'm like, that's why what? Because the pharmacist want me to prescribe Ezetrol, you know, the brand.
Yeah, the brand.
Yeah, the brand, which is like £27 drug tariff, right? So the pharmacist is not losing out on their dispensing fee and on their markup. So I'm like, okay, you know what? I said, I'm going to stay out of this. I said, it's up to you. This is how much they cost. This is what we get paid. This is what we're really. I said, you decide whatever you want to do. So she said, all right. So I think a lot of it, and I think it's difficult. The margins are difficult for pharmacies. So unfortunately, you may get some pushback from pharmacists asking for different brands or more expensive brands to help them cover the cost of dispensing the medication. So be aware of that. That's a side little note from me. So all you prescribers out there.
That's good to know. Thanks, Ara. I think another thing that's worth mentioning in this podcast are SSPs or serious shortage protocols. So as our listeners may or may not know, the Department of Health and Social Care can sometimes decide that if there is a serious shortage of a specific medication or appliance, then an SSP is issued, where a community pharmacist can issue an alternative without actually getting a prescription changed by the general practice team. So, and I think if I can think of some examples, I think some antibiotics we had, you know, last year. So I think it's important for, of course, the community pharmacy team to utilize this. And also, it's also important for the general practice team to be aware of this as well. So rather than dealing with those prescriptions, just, you know, inform the community pharmacist team that use the SSP if it's there, that's what it's there for. What's been your experience, Arif, in terms of, you know, generally how community pharmacies are utilizing the sort of leeway that they've got? Are they afraid of changing things, or do you feel like it's not a problem? What are your thoughts?
I've got three different things to say about it. So number one, the SSP list is not very extensive. If there was like 20, 30 drugs on there, you know, with all the main kind of drugs that are out of stock right now that, you know, are on the list, I think that'll be much more helpful. It's a very, very conservative list, I would say. I have used it and I do use it. I used it a lot last year when we were going through the penicillin crisis a year ago. Penicillin, clarithromycin. I mean, clarithromycin is still out of stock, by the way, the suspension 250. So, but it's not on the SSP. So clarithromycin is out of stock and it's been out of stock for a very long time, but it's not. And so that's a good example. It's not on the SSP. So that's the first thing. It really, I think the Department of Social Care and Health really need to kind of push on that. And then what will happen, going to my next point, which is pharmacists will become more comfortable. So I'm a prescribing pharmacist. I guess I'm used to, in a certain way, that, you know, pharmacy first. So I've got a pretty busy pharmacy. I have a second pharmacist. I use about 3-4 locums on every day, basically, regular. So we've been talking about pharmacy first and all for the last month. And they are absolutely petrified of pharmacy first. I mean, they're experienced pharmacists, but they're like, what if I miss my red flag? What if this happens? What if that happens? Oh my God. What if I say, give them this and they don't need it? And what if I don't give it and they do need it? You know, all these kind of fears, you know, prescribing, even though it's a PGD. And I think it's going to take time. What pharmacists need to get into that kind of mindset, confidence of giving out medication without a prescription, whether that's because they're prescribing or PGD or anything like that. I think when that happens, things like SSPs and those kind of structures like Pharmacy First, I think you start seeing it more and more and more. So I think like most advances, it's multifaceted. I don't think there's a silver bullet. Probably the Department of Health can do a bit more to help. Pharmacists probably can do more to help by using these facilities. But what happens is if the Department of Health do not see these facilities being used, they probably think it's not much use in investing more time and effort into creating more SSPs. So it's a bit of a downward spiral, right? Mm-hmm. It's a bit like Fonsi first. If we're not going to take Fonsi first by the scruff of his neck, then the government's going to like, well, we've invested all these millions of pounds in advertising and putting all the IT systems in place, and you guys are barely doing a few thousand a month. So I think it's really up to pharmacies, community pharmacies, to really, really work through our... I always say that, you know, when we're in university, our courses are very risk-averse courses. Like, we're told, you know, again and again, double check this, double check that, make sure you don't do this, make sure you don't do that. You know, we're very, very, very risk-averse. And I think a lot of that is within the pharmacist psyche. So we do need to kind of break that mold. But I think people like you guys, like prescribing, going out there in community, working with GPs, I think it's really helped our sector kind of progress. But community pharmacists, I think, are falling behind because they haven't worked in that GP or hospital setting or prison. I don't know if any of you ever worked in prison before. Have you worked in prison? I mean, I locumed many moons ago. I had more hair on my head back then. You know what? I could give out medication without a prescription. You would dispense first and the prescription would arrive 2 days later. Whoa, I was like mind blown. I was like, is this legal? What's going on? I was completely mind blown. Because of the way prison systems work, you can't wait for a GP or a doctor. It might be days before that. You have to use your clinical judgment, patient's PMR, their history. I mean, I'm talking about repeats and all that. I'm not talking about just initiating, you know, methadone or venlafaxine of your own accord. But yeah, this is what I mean. Very, very interesting when you look into the psyche of the pharmacist that we're very risk averse. So we need to push ourselves. And I think if we push ourselves, then the other sectors will kind of take more note of us and hopefully will help us move forward and use things like SSP more. And yeah, it might make everyone's life a little bit easier.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, actually, with regards to the psyche of a pharmacist. I absolutely agree with you. I do feel that quite a lot of community pharmacists, they do lack the confidence. In our last podcast, Armin, if you recall, when we were talking about pharmacists, that, you know, confidence comes with knowledge and with experience. So it's actually slightly reassuring that, you know, some of the pharmacists are, you know, not sort of jumping to it. It shows that, you know, they are taking that responsibility serious. But obviously, as long as they do something about that to get that confidence and progress clinically, because if they don't do anything about it, then they won't develop as clinicians. So really interesting point. Amina, have you got anything else to say?
I was just quickly going to say regarding, you know, caution. Caution can be valuable. It depends on how you apply it. Okay, so I understand the psyche of a pharmacist because we're coming from a position where we have been the support system for the prescribers. Now we are becoming the prescribers and we are being involved in, you know, diagnostics and things like that. So we're pushing the boundaries of what a traditional pharmacist does. And so many of us still understand that original psyche of a pharmacist where we are cautious. We are the safety net at the end of the day. And I think that caution is useful when you're in that role as the supporter. But when you're in the role as the prescriber, you are the final decision maker. And so that caution can be helpful or it can hold you back. So it depends on the situation you're in. You can use it to your advantage or it might be something that holds you back in the long term. I just want to say a couple of quick things before we wrap it up. And that is from the perspective of our prescribers and our supporting pharmacists within general practice. What I would say to you is please keep up to date and in touch with any local or national guidance related to medication shortages. Okay, so this is where you might have a guidance or protocol in place regarding how you clinically assess a patient who is taking a medication that is no longer available or there is a shortage around. So, I mean, the two that come to mind is the ADHD guidance. That was a national guidance and there was local guidance related to that as well. And the guidance around GLP-1. So there's a lot of work has gone into producing those guidances. So I would strongly recommend that you are well averse with them. The other thing that I would do is that you need to be on the same page with the other clinicians in the surgery. So for example, if you're saying, I'm not going to prescribe X, Y, and Z for this reason, then actually you need to have that kind of joint communication with the rest of the practice to make sure the other prescribers are doing something similar, because what you don't want to do is send out a mixed message to your patients that, if you come on a certain day and speak to a certain clinician, you're going to get what you want or what, you know, what you're requesting. And if you come on another day, you might not, because you end up speaking to Amina, who says no to everything. Only joking. I don't. So, you know, the point is, you know, be on the same page when it comes to prescribing. If you're going to have a policy in place that meets, say, the national guidance or a local guidance, make sure everybody understands, everybody within your practice. And also, just another quick point, just regarding secondary care. Some of the things that we see sometimes in primary care is, although we may be following the guidance really, really strictly, we find that secondary care doesn't always heed the guidance. And we get numerous letters from secondary care from departments I will not mention, who will say, oh, can you please prescribe X, Y, and Z? You know, so they want us to initiate things that we know that are actively under issues with shortage, knowing that within primary care, actually, we're being advised not to initiate these things. So anybody working on the interface or working within the MMTs or working in secondary care, please, we have to be singing from the same hymn sheet. Okay, if we're expected to do something in primary care, that should translate into secondary care. And often, we're talking about the psyche of a pharmacist. Think about the psyche of a patient. If you say no to a patient and then someone else says, yeah, you look like the bad guy, that is not a favorable position to be in. So we should all be saying whatever we're saying in the same way rather than contradicting each other, I think. And that sort of shows that united front and shows that actually the messaging is correct. It's not that we are being unfair, whatever it is that sometimes patients may feel about the system. It's the system that is working against us, and we need to do our very, very best to turn that around and make it work in our favor.
Absolutely. Thank you, Amina. I think, you know, you've given some really practical advice there for our pharmacists to take away and, you know, use those tips to help navigate these issues. Arif, any final words of advice from you?
We'll let you have the last word, Ari.
No, I just wanted to say thanks for bringing me on board. It's been nice to have a little chat.
Yeah,
no, I think, like I said earlier, communication. I think what you've just basically said, Amina, communication, if everyone's kind of, you know, like you said, singing on the same hymn sheet, we then move forward in the same way. We're a team. A team, you know, means everyone's got the same goals, the same objective. When you're a multidisciplinary team, means you are of different disciplines, but they're part of the same team. So I think we all need to work together. There's going to be bumps along the way, but we've got to try to support each other in whatever way we can. If GP pharmacists and GPs can liaise with their community pharmacists, because we're scaredy cats sometimes. And so try to help us along. And I promise you, you'll get good returns for your effort.
Thank you, Aaron. And I think also just a final little words from me is that what we also have is we have some general guidance for dealing with out of stock items that we use for our internal pharmacists, the pharmacists that work with the clinical pharmacy solutions that we often provide to our pharmacy technicians. Of course, there are IPs and non-IPs as well. So we have specific guidance for who can do what in terms of, you know, some patients might need clinical reviews, explaining when a clinical review might be needed, when it's just a case of issuing an alternative. And also we have some guidance in terms of which resources and tools are available out there. There are some fantastic tools which you guys have touched upon as well, and that it's important for the pharmacist to utilize those. So we are happy to make that available publicly as a free resource. So the pharmacists who are listening, just head over to our academy and we will link those resources as well as a description to this podcast. So yeah, I think that's all we've got time for. I think it has been a fantastic discussion, very productive, very much needed as well. It's been great to get your insight, Arif, based on your experiences. And Amina, it's always a pleasure to have you and get your practical insight and tips. And hopefully everyone listening has benefited. So thank you both again for joining me.
Thank you, Runa.
Thank you.